hearing, we're good, right?
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this March 25th. Ooh, the session's going fast, huh? And open a public hearing on House Bill 3383 and ask Representative Parrish to join us.
Thank you, Chair Greenlech, members of the Healthcare Committee. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. Part of me would rather be here today because the Ed hearing looks quite contentious. So glad to be here in front of you all instead. House Bill 3388 is really kind of a follow-on in my mind from conversations in the 2011 session where we looked at Senate Bill 97 from that session, which was about cultural competency in medicine. And, I think you all know, my grandmother, my family came here from the Middle East. My grandmother, for all 30 years she lived here, never bothered to learn how to speak English. And bless the doctors who took care of her because she was a cranky patient who didn't speak English. And I think her care at Providence was fantastic. They did a great job with her. And I think that's true of all doctors and practitioners. You know, I've seen them myself all up and down the I-5 corridor, having lived throughout Oregon. And I think our practitioners do a fantastic job with care. So when Senate Bill 97 came, and I was on healthcare last session, some of the folks who brought those bills forward, when they came to my office, they talked about some of their reasons for it. And one, particular reason really stuck out in my head. Somebody who came and shared in my office that had Senate Bill 97 passed, their relative, who was Filipino, would have been... the doctor would have caught their cancer sooner. Apparently, Filipino men needed some kind of screening by a certain timeline. And I didn't quite get the sense of how that bill, which actually is kind of more along the lines of a sensitivity type training CEUs around cultural specific medicine, would actually have led to an outcome where the doctor would have known to screen for whatever type of cancer. And so, I kind of really wrestled around with it because we want in healthcare all of us to have good outcomes. We want us to have good experiences. And those things need to be customized to who we are and where we're at in the minute of our life. And so, when I walk into a doctor, I want to, have them understand that, Julie Parrish is a 38-year-old woman of Middle Eastern descent who's had three babies, probably needed to lose a few pounds and haven't seen the doctor in 2 years. What are the specific conversations that that doctor and I need to have? And so I don't believe that Senate bill was the answer to a customized type healthcare. And what I really think I'd like us to consider, so this is just a conversation starter to get us going, but, doctors and our nurse practitioners and folks who are doing the intake, they're charting, they're online. They have access to the internet in most cases, and it would be nice for them to be able to go to a site that our health authority, someone in our government is managing, where data is being aggregated on an algorithm that essentially they can plug in the issues of race, gender, age, any kind of anomalies, and get really current evidence-based healthcare data that will lead to that conversation that I think the proponents of Senate Bill 97 want to see happen at the doctor's office. I think it has to be data-driven and outcome-driven and have real information behind it. This bill might not be the way to get us there, and I get that, but I really think that we should look at how we get specific medicine, customized medicine for all of us, really needs to be designed in a data-driven way, and my goal is to try to help start that conversation and how we actually solve that problem so people really are getting the best quality care, and when the somebody who is Filipino and needs a cancer screening, that when they have that conversation and the doctor is able to input that data, that's flagged for the conversation so that somebody really can get the health care that they need. So that's what this bill is about. That's why I brought it forward, because I really struggled with the fact that we didn't solve that issue in 2011, and even had we solved it with that bill, it wouldn't really be solved. And I'd like to make sure that if we're going to try to talk about cultural medicine or gender-specific or any of the other kinds of demographical types of health care that need to be provided based on those factors, that we're doing it in a data-driven way. So with that, that's kind of the nexus of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Rep. Parrish.
Hold on just a moment.
I'm cut off again.
Just a second, please. Gretchen Morley's there. Gretchen, why don't you go? Gretchen's from the Ooper. Huh? I've asked her to come and talk about this bill, but also be available to answer questions. So why don't you go now, and we'll see.
Okay, thanks. Again. And thank you again for bringing the bill.
Don't be interrupted again.
Mr. Chairman, please do not interrupt.
So, I'm questioning, I guess, along the lines of whether the state is the place to, who we should charge with responsibility for this. OHA seems like a perfectly reasonable place within the state agencies. I just very quickly tried to get into the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and I'm into their statistics area, but I haven't found the type of thing that you're talking about. So do you know if there's anyone else nationally, regionally, that has a database of this sort that we might?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I've looked. I haven't found anything, but I don't think it can't be built. No. I also don't think it can't be built frankly, inexpensively. I know like some of the WebMD type sites and things have data, but not that, you know, be able to do a search. And I think that there are enough people doing search, private companies. I don't think this is like the health exchange that we have to get $48 million and build it internally and, you know, see if it, it flies. I think there are enough private data companies out there that do search and search algorithm that could, you know, we're these types of, you know, studies and researches and things could be populated for search. And so I think that there's some opportunity to be innovative here.
Hello?
Yes.
You like these things to just roll, but since you were into interrupting mode, I thought I'd give you the opportunity.
Well, I'm going to wait for you to start.
Be careful, you'll get mad.
So, but I agree with everything you said. I think the private sector could do this very well, or maybe the feds. But the Section 1.1 says the OHA shall compile and continuously update the database.
Yep.
I just don't want us to get into the situation where we are trying to build something that would be better off built by others. So I guess that's on the record now.
Well, can I just, I'll just say, whether it's OHA, Oregon Health Science University, we'll send it up to Mitch, they can do it up there. Regardless of who that entity is, I mean, that's absolutely flexible and can be changed. But I think it doesn't, it makes sense to me that the Oregon Health Authority is at least overseeing that, even if it is contracted out to a private company to do that. But somebody has to have some level of accountability to make sure that whatever, if we could find somebody who wants to get into search and do this piece and really design something. I think the opportunity to design something not only is for Oregon. I mean, I think there's that opportunity to kind of be a leader in health search in that online database field. So, but somebody still needs to kind of be their oversight.
My impression is that the electronic medical record systems have this, at least intended to have this kind of information.
Yeah.
It's depending on the extent to which how deep and broad it goes is an important issue. Representative Widener?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually signed on to this bill, and the thing that kind of intrigued me about it is because WebMD. My wife spends a lot of time on WebMD, and we've heard a lot of the cultural things that happen here, and if there's a way for us to provide that information to companies that are out there without saying anybody's name or violating any HIPAA records, where that way WebMD, you can just do a search that I'm a Hispanic male or white male or black male, and these are the common things or what I should be checked for in a timely manner is the big thing, because now, I mean, my wife would be on there and have all the kids and me doing what I'm supposed to every time, but it's how do we gather that data or information that we could put it out there for the public to see that colon cancer is very common or a 50% chance that you're going to get it if you're a white male that eats cheeseburgers. Well, then,
switch
I probably should
hamburgers,
switch to hamburgers and I'm okay. But I think this is where we need to go to really drive down the cost, because then people have the information at their own hands and they don't even, unless it persists, then they go see a doctor, but they'll be able to take care of a lot of the stuff on their own. So a lot of the mechanical stuff that they need to before something really dramatic happens to them. So.
And I just, ideally, this is forward-facing. This isn't just something that, you know, would be accessible to a practitioner. Really, I mean, it would be great if people, if we were able to build something like this, it would be great if people could take control of their own health care. We're asking them to do that by being better in the CCO models. We're asking them to, our PEB employees through the health engagement model. This would be just another extension of some of that, where we're asking the public to kind of forward-facing, be thinking about that data, and then being able to go to their own doctor and initiate a conversation too, if they're aware of what needs to be looked at. If I could plug that information in and see that I'm overdue for something, it might get me to the doctor sooner than 2 years ago. So,
Rich, you have some comments on this? Think about the feasibility of something like that.
Sure. My name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of health analytics for the health authority now. And this actually feeds directly into this conversation because the leadership of the health authority fully supports getting data in the forefront, getting evidence-based research out there to improve and support health systems transformation. There's been a number of alignments done within the health authority in terms of my CHOP is a new internal sort of organizing of the data and research staff within the health authority and what folks have historically thought of as the Office for Health Policy and Research. And so that's one endeavor, and there's also the newly created Transformation Center that would be doing just this in the sense of trying to figure out what information's out there that would be the most useful for our CCOs and for other entities in managing care and creating the right incentives within their systems. So the overall structure is one which I think we're all headed in the same direction. A lot of the current discussion in-house is how do we get our data the most accessible and best organized on our website. And so there's some steps that have been taken. There are a lot more we need to do in order to make our data easily accessible, ideally create interactive tools on the website so you're able to customize data looks at the community or CCO level, that kind of thing. So those are all in the planning stage. We don't currently have this kind of database planned. It would be a new project for the health authority. I think there is, my understanding, and this is not a place that I've spent a ton of time, I know that there's a website called MedInsight that is run from the federal level that has thousands of searchable articles. I think from our perspective, we would be somewhat replicating that database, or it would be it would be a new undertaking that we'd have to figure out what the parameters are in terms of what's the scope, how much, it really probably, in terms of what it looks like, could be dialed up or down depending on the resources put toward it. And so that it would need, in terms of the bill is very broad at this point, and so it would need some additional work to figure out what the full scope of it is and what the expectations are out of the database. So I'll stop there and see what.
Questions?
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank both of you.
Thank you. Appreciate the time. And, I just feel like we walked out of that last session and want to make sure that, people know we are thinking about these things and try to find a way to solve them and make sure that, that the data really does help people along to get better health outcomes. So I think I know from serving with some of you up on this committee before, that's certainly your objective as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring it forward. And, I'd love to work with the Oregon Health Authority on trying to, make this more dynamic and figure out what we can do and, even bring that back in a subsequent session. So,
great. Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2118. I'm sorry, wrong number. 3383. That takes two checks, right? And open up a public hearing on HCR 16. Can you tell us about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 16 recognizes addiction as a disease and resolves that prevention and treatment should address both biological and environmental factors.
Thank you. We have Marvin Stennis, please, and Jonathan Ames. Is that right? I have that right?
Okay. Representing. That's my resolution.
Oh, please.
With Marvin.
We know who to blame then now.
Yeah. We'll see in a moment who you
are.
There, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from here in District 21, which you're sitting in now, post-redistricting. The capital came into District 21. And I wanted to just briefly...
How many votes in here?
What's that?
Not many votes.
No, not many votes. I wanted to just briefly talk about a couple of the concepts in the resolution. Marvin is really the one who's educated me over the last 4 years. He's a constituent. We've also been on the ballot opposing each other, in quotes, the last 4 years. But really, we have had a pretty great effort together, I think, to make, separate from this issue, to make it clear you can be on the ballot for the same seat and not be hostile to each other. But I've learned a lot about this issue in particular from Marvin, and he has some more detailed information, some more personal stories. But for me, it's been very educational as we've particularly talked to editorial boards, and we've tried to get in front of more young people to talk about prevention of addiction-related problems before they occur. But I just wanted to touch on a couple of things. For example, the Betty Ford Center on their website has an article that really sums it up. It says, the disease of addiction, like other diseases, is chronic and organic. It sights the brain as its target organ. It relapses. It remits. It is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But treated one day at a time, lasting recovery is the promise for each and every alcoholic or addict afflicted. All that is required is that they have the willingness to take the first steps. In 2011, the American Society of Addiction Medicine worked, culminated a four-year process involving more than 80 experts, and I just want to read you two quotes and then I'll stop. At its core, addiction isn't just a social problem or a moral problem or a criminal problem. It's a brain problem whose behavior manifests in all these areas, said Dr. Michael Miller, past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, who oversaw the development of this new definition. Many behaviors driven by addiction are real problems and sometimes criminal acts, but the disease is about brains, not drugs. It's about underlying neurology, not outward actions. So it's being recognized at the national level, but one of the things we want to do is have this philosophy more incorporated in the policy decisions and the actions we make. So I think I'll stop. Marvin will be able to talk to you about what that actually looks like, but certainly in many places where we're chasing societal ills, if you're not dealing with addiction, you're just going to keep spending money on incarceration, on after-the-fact types of things, when it can be solved in a much more direct medical manner over time. Doesn't mean you excuse the behaviors, but it does mean you get ahead of the curve. So with that, I would finish my testimony and let you hear from Marvin Sanis.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm very excited. I'm Marvin Sanis. I live at 640 15th Street Northeast. I'm blocked from North Salem High School. Right now, there are thousands of parents in the Salem area who are pulling their hair out. They've got a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old who has begun the road into addiction. Now, that child, everybody in his family, all his friends, his teachers, they all know within a few weeks that this kid has begun to experiment with substance abuse. The most powerful number I have, I think, our high school graduation rate in Oregon is 68%. You can walk over here to North Salem High School and ask a junior, why aren't your friends graduating from high school? And if you talk to 10 kids, 9 of them will tell you, they're smoked up under the bridge. They're drinking. They found coke. They're into meth. They take their mom's pills. That's why 32% of our kids are not graduating from high school. Now, the only people that can understand addictive disease, that can understand that it can flourish in an 11 and 12-year-old, are the 11 and 12-year-olds who have been through it, or the parents of an 11 and 12-year-old. We lost Eric 11 years ago. His mother and I went to Tough Love in Kaiser every Wednesday night for 4 years, trying to address behaviors. And we worked on concepts like consequences, accountability, raise the bottom. Would we do that to our child if they had the flu? Would we do that to our child if they had diabetes? This is a disease. This is an illness. And if it's addressed with medical, as a medical problem, we have an opportunity. I'm just so proud of Brian for doing this. This Oregon has an opportunity to leap from the 19th century with addictive disease into the 21st century. They've been doing this in Europe for decades, and they're making huge strides. 60% of the illegal drugs consumed on the planet, produced on the planet, are consumed in the United States. We're 5% of the population. Our kids are loaded. Now, the reason that this thing is so crucial, because these parents of the 10-year-old, 12-year-old, they need a medical option. You know, I've known about addictive disease for a long time. Going through it with my own son, did not seek out a medical option until it was very, very late in his disease, and we lost him. You know, when I was running with Brian, a woman called me up, and she said, Marvin, I have to tell you my story. I knew my son was an alcoholic. He began when he was 10. His father was an alcoholic. His grandfather was an alcoholic. He had uncles. It was rife through the family. She said, I tried everything to get this problem addressed. I couldn't get no one's attention until he was arrested at 15. And the cycle of corrections, juvenile detention, that began. That becomes very expensive. If we begin, give the parents a medical option when the child is first beginning, when we all know what's going to happen. Anyway, I don't think this is going to cost anything. I think if this thing gets through this legislative assembly, I think this will be national. I think this will be international news that the Oregon legislature made this leap. Boy, I've got a lot more numbers and a lot more information, but...
Let's hold it for the day.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Prevention Education Recovery Association, otherwise known as OPRA, which is the statewide association for alcohol and drug treatment centers. Thank you, Representative Clem. Thank you, Marvin, for bringing this today. And that story that Marvin has expressed to you is all too common here in the state of Oregon. And when I brought this bill up to our members, the first reaction that they had was, well, how could we not? Don't we already do that already? And unfortunately, over the years, having testified on a number of these bills, and frankly, this is the first time this legislative session I haven't had to testify under 3 minutes, so I'm going to slow down a little bit.
you have 2 minutes. Yeah.
You know, having testified on this, there's a lot of anecdotes that you hear, and there's a lot of personal stories, because addiction touches so many people, almost everybody. I don't know anybody. I haven't met anybody who hasn't touched it, hasn't touched yet. And so often we make decisions and policy based upon individual anecdotes, when really what we need to do is what our CCOs are doing right now, which is looking at outcome-based medicine, putting this in the proper place that it deserves to be, which is in science-based, approaching this from a science, you know, science-based with measures and outcomes, and that's how addiction should be treated, not as anecdotal or pull yourself up by the bootstraps or the common themes I've heard a lot of other places. Well, if they just try harder, they're going to get better. This is a disease, and addiction needs to be treated like that. So we do support this bill, and we encourage the legislature to pass it. And hopefully this sends a message not only to our leaders here, whom, to be honest, I know a number of them do believe and approach this addiction as a disease, but this will give them the added incentive to treat this just like diabetes or hypertension or any of those. And frankly, it's hard for us to It's hard for me, having and personal family members that are affected by this, to get in that mindset that, you know what, if they had just not gone down the wrong track, or you know, if they not had those friends, if we can get into, well, they were susceptible and that their mind and their body chemistry was made up in a different way, if we can get to that point, I think we're going to be better as a state. So thank you very much. We support the passage of this bill.
Brian, I wonder, I served as the chair of the National Academy of Science Committee on bringing research and treatment together in addiction services. Was Bridging the Gap was the report. Even at that time, I think the language would be stronger in your statement. I mean, I would think they should say something like, recognize that addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disorder with behavioral effects. Now, I'll be glad to work with you.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's basically the NIH is defined, a clear definition of this, the National Institute of Substance Abuse. The and I also wonder if it's really the members of the Legislative Assembly or the Legislative Assembly that declares. Is this what the Council suggested as?
Mr. Chair, I think whenever they do resolutions, they write that as we, the members of the 77th Assembly, declare blah, 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 blah. I think so. I've seen that a lot.
Mr. Kenimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that idea. I think it needs some wordsmithing, and it ought to be in much harsher terms, or dramatic terms. Maybe harsh is not quite the right word.
Starker
terms. I mean, it's very alarming. I was sitting here next to Representative Kenny Geyer and thinking she and Representative Tomei and Representative Parrish and I have been working on the legislature. The legislature is addicted to lottery. I think it's a fair statement, and you know, we've been talking about there's 71,000 Oregonians, 71,000 that are addicted to video lottery in Oregon. Just the impact of that is gigantic, and we're talking about drugs and alcohol and a plethora of other things, frankly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kenimer. One thing I don't think Marvin's heard me talk about, because it's a sensitive topic, but we have a family member who is addicted to gambling. It's caused a lot of problems in my family, serious ones, financial, legal, lots of problems. And I remember early when we, you know, figured this out, my brother took it a different way. I mean, really angry, and you know, this was via marriage, so it was more about why don't you get a divorce, get her out of our life, and it was causing real problems that weren't to be minimized. But even I, this is going 1994, even I was like, well, she's sick though, you know, this is a sickness, and yeah, it's screwing up everybody else's life, but it's a sickness, but she cannot stay off of those poker machines, no matter what, you know, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars now in damage to people who can't afford it either, and fake credit cards and all kinds of stuff. I'm sure with some medical help, it could be dealt with. It's just, you know, it touches almost every family somewhere, some way. It's just for some of us really close to home, and in Marvin's case, even more so, obviously, with Eric. So thank you for the opportunity today.
Great. Yes, sir, Representative Thompson.
Yeah, I absolutely support this in concept, but I don't think there's any language we can use that can make it strong enough in terms of what needs to be done. I think we've made a first step, though, with the Affordable Care Act, including substance abuse,
uh-huh,
along with mental health, into primary care. Now, that's initially only for the Medicaid population, but it opens the door, and it's something that we can work with. And the other point is, notwithstanding the incredible group of people that Jonathan represents, that was a freebie, I threw it in for you, I think we have a lot of work we have to do on exactly what treatment is. I've gone through this up close and personal with a family member, and $30,000 later, we still have a disease. And I find that's very common in my district when I give talks or town halls on drugs. People come out of the woodwork that have spent tens of thousands of dollars on treatment that didn't work. So somewhere, if there was ever a point that we need to get to a best practices point really fast, it's with drug, particularly meth treatment, and alcoholism is very serious, but I think it's a little easier to deal with. But we really have to look at this not only medically, but beyond medically, we have to look at exactly what we can do that works, and then start getting rid of stuff that doesn't work, and focus a little better. But it's, I have absolutely no idea what the impact on our economy is, but it's enormous when you add in all of the wreckage it creates in families, plus the theft and everything else that is generated to support the habit. And it is a major economic hit to us socially as well as economically. But,
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I couldn't agree more. You know, one of the goals and benefits of some passing something like this, or even in, I agree with you, more starker terms, Representative Kettemer, as a psychologist, understands this, is that we do start treating it like other diseases. You know, if you are a diabetic and you have a problem with your insulin, or maybe you ate something that you shouldn't have eaten and you relapse, you know, I don't think people look at that and say, well, that's a big failure. That guy just didn't, we have to treat this like that. And from our perspective, from the treatment providers, we're very willing and want to be held to certain outcomes for what works. Understanding, of course, that people relapse and people fail, and it takes multiple times to be able to be successful in addiction medicine. But we welcome that, and we want to be brought into that community of those, as you would a doctor or an orthopedist who is looking at what works as far as knee surgeries or something like that. We welcome that opportunity.
Can I say two points? The most effective thing is to begin at the beginning, the 10, 11, 12-year-olds. If we address the problem there, get this awareness to the parents so they have a medical option, that's where we can really make an impact. You know, we try to address it now in corrections or in the juvenile system. You know, our corrections, the first time I ran against Brian, 14 institutions, treatment in 6 of those institutions. We know 70% of our inmate population is identified with addictive disorder, but we only offer treatment in 6 of the 14 institutions. It's very cost effective. It's not that expensive to do. But the main thing is to begin early. Begin early. 10, 11, 12-year-olds. That's where we can really have an impact.
I'm going to close this hearing. We'll work with you on some some suggested language and bring it back.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you very much for bringing it to us. Closing the public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 16 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 2118, and I'm going to call Arthur Tower, Jesse O'Brien, and Janet Bauer to start us off. Would you describe what we have, and then tell me what we're working on is the Dash 1 amendment to the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendment prohibits insurers certified by Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation from reimbursing for acquired conditions not covered by Medicare from having medical loss ratio below 85%. It requires plans offered by CoverOregon to have acceptable consumer and provider satisfaction ratings, to not contract with providers with record of adverse outcomes due to negligence. It creates a metrics rating committee appointed by CoverOregon to identify outcome and quality measures. It requires CoverOregon to review and report quality and outcome data. It requires CoverOregon to negotiate lowest premium cost sharing before certifying plan. That requires CoverOregon to update quality improvement strategies at least every 2 years. It becomes operative January 1st, 2017.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. I'm here today to testify in favor of the Dash 1 amendments. Although there is a slight change we would like to make to those. But in short, as I've testified before this committee before, Our union represents 20,000 care providers who don't currently have employment-based health care, child care providers and home care providers for seniors and people with disabilities, and adult foster home operators. We have 4,200 home care workers who do have insurance, but we're actively exploring the idea that these workers could forego traditional employment-based insurance and instead purchase insurance through the exchange. But to do that, we want to make sure that the exchange is as high-functioning and as consumer-friendly as possible. We think that if we can combine the standards set forth in CCOs with those of public purchasers and line all those up with the exchange, that we could drive the market and drive a real change in the delivery system. As we continue to push toward a model of preventive care and cost containment, we have to continue to look ahead. And that's why we feel that the amendments that are before you today make a lot of sense. We think that having the exchange operate as an active purchaser rather than as an open marketplace is the right way to go. We think that having the exchange shape the affordability and quality of the insurance plans is going to be paramount to the success of the exchange and making it an attractive option for our members. Other states have already done this, California and Massachusetts most notably, and we'd like to see Cover Oregon get there for the 2015 open enrollment period. And that's the a big improvement, I think, over the current language in the dash ones. We fear that even with the federal subsidies and tax credits, that many of our members will still struggle to meet the premiums on the exchange. When our child care providers were eligible for FEOP, premium share or the co-pays, even the modest levels, proved to be quite a barrier. If folks don't participate because of these financial barriers, then the benefit of prevention will really be by the wayside. So we think that it's important to Cover Oregon negotiate on premium rates and cost share. The Dash 1 amendments don't tell Cover Oregon how to establish a premium negotiation program, but we're confident such a system could be designed that fits the needs of Cover Oregon and would benefit Oregon's consumers. There are ideas in the Dash 1s that we really like quite a bit, and I just want to emphasize a couple of those. We want to make sure that no plan in Cover Oregon has a medical loss ratio below 85%. And that gets adjusted upward over time. We want a quality metrics rating committee to be established to align quality metrics with those of the CCOs where it makes sense. We think the qualified health plans should submit a plan of action to Cover Oregon that shows that providers with the worst outcomes will be excluded from the qualified health plans. With that, I think I'll conclude my remarks. I have longer written testimony, and happy to answer any questions.
Jesse?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien, healthcare advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, also known as OSPIRG. OSPIRG supports this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. We think this legislation would be a huge step forward for Oregon's health insurance exchange. It can help ensure that the exchange lives up to its full potential to really make healthcare work better for all Oregonians. I want to commend Cover Oregon's staff and board for the incredible work that they are doing and have done building a better, more transparent health insurance marketplace for Oregon consumers and small businesses. I think Oregon can expect to have a much better functioning exchange than most of the rest of the nation, and that is due entirely to their hard work. However, we do feel that more action is called for to make sure that the exchange is in the best position moving forward. And the biggest part of that is that an important part of the promise of an exchange is that once you have this large marketplace set up, the exchange can leverage the purchasing power of the hundreds of thousands of Oregonians who are eligible for subsidies and will only be able to access those subsidies via an exchange, that the exchange can leverage that buying power to drive a hard bargain with the insurance industry to contain costs, cut waste, improve quality of care, and build value for consumers. So Cover Oregon has somewhat limited leverage before they actually have any covered lives, as they do not right now. But their ability to push insurers on cost and quality is only going to grow as people sign up and there's a really fully functioning marketplace there. We feel that this legislation and the Dash 1 amendments will give Cover Oregon the tools it will need to take full advantage of that opportunity for the 2015 open enrollment period. And it may not be totally clear in the Dash 1s as they are written that that is what this is meant to be aimed at, and there may be some changes that need to be made, but that, that was the intention of the Dash 1s. So some of the important steps in these Dash 1s that will enable Cover Oregon to take better advantage of that leverage are, first of all, giving the exchange a specific mandate to negotiate premium rates with participating insurers. This is the single biggest step that Oregon can take to ensure that the exchange is doing everything it can to keep down costs. There are a number of different ways that an exchange can be set up along these lines, and I think that since we have until the 2015 open enrollment period to figure out how this works, Cover Oregon should study a range of possible options before moving forward, and also consider, of course, the experience that they have over the first year or so of enrollment in the exchange. One question that I know has come up when this subject has, when this possibility has been raised before, is the interaction between negotiating premium rates and the Oregon Insurance Division's health insurance rate review program. And what I would say is that these are actually somewhat unrelated issues. The health insurance rate review program is about evaluating whether a rate is reasonable, whether it is something that through a regulatory process the state is willing to allow to be offered on the marketplace at all. But Cover Oregon is in a different position because they, if we are able to move forward with these Dash 1 amendments, they will be able to act as an active purchaser on behalf of consumers, which is really not how the health insurance rate review program is currently constructed. Cover Oregon can use its leverage as an advocate for consumers to bring them lower cost plans. So other advances in the Dash 1s include strengthening the exchange's standards for cost containment and quality improvement. So as laid out in the Affordable Care Act, there are a number of different strategies that plans on exchanges can use to basically show that they're improving quality of care, but each one of them is also associated with reduced costs by refocusing care toward prevention, trying to eliminate medical errors, cutting waste out of the delivery system, because each of these strategies is associated with a lot of wasteful spending, unnecessary spending in the healthcare delivery system. So I won't go into a great detail about how these work, but our proposal is that the exchange continue to build off of the list that they have already established. There are two strategies that the exchange has already established for participating plans. We would like to see that double for the next open enrollment, and we would like the exchange to consider adding additional strategies, including state-specific strategies that the exchange could come up with, and I'd be glad to go into more detail about that if the committee's interested. But finally, the medical loss ratio standard. Medical loss ratio is the percentage of premium that's spent on medical care instead of going to administration, profit, or marketing. Oregon, thanks in part to its strong health insurance rate review program, has some of the highest MLRs in the nation. We feel that Cover Oregon will be in a great position to contribute to building on that success down the line. The Dash 1 amendments propose a standard of 85%, which is above the federal standard of 80% that was laid out in the Affordable Care Act for these plans. We feel that that's a very achievable goal.
You wrap it up, please.
Absolutely, sorry. And we do think that by taking all these steps together, Cover Oregon will put itself in a much better position to succeed and deliver more affordable, better quality care for Oregon consumers. And we would urge your support for the Dash 1 amendments. Sorry for taking so long.
Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer, and I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We analyze tax, budget, and economic data with the goal of advancing public policies for the benefit of low and moderate income Oregonians. I'm here today to testify in support of the bill in question with the Dash One amendments, and in particular, its directive for Cover Oregon to negotiate with its insurers. We have analyzed and written about the important role of Oregon's exchange in negotiating for best prices and benefits. I want to outline today why this role is important to low and moderate income Oregonians in particular in purchasing coverage in Cover Oregon with the federal subsidies. The affordability of coverage is important to all Oregonians, including low and moderate income Oregonians. Affordability will be important in Oregon's exchange because people will be more likely to purchase exchange coverage rather than go uninsured and pay the penalty. Obviously, more participants in Oregon's exchange contributes to its success. Individuals getting federal subsidies will pay a share of their income towards the premium cost. The federal subsidy will make up the difference at a level pegged at the cost of a silver level plan. Low and moderate income individuals will likely struggle to afford coverage in Cover Oregon even with the subsidies, and will be at risk of dropping coverage if they don't have the cash each and every month to maintain their coverage. I would like to give you some examples to illustrate why we believe some may struggle to afford coverage even with the federal subsidies. If Cover Oregon were operating today, here are some amounts people will pay in the exchange with federal subsidies purchasing a silver level plan. For instance, a two-person family with gross income of $23,000 will pay about $78 per month. That amounts to $931 a year, not including any copays. The out-of-pocket maximum for this family will be over $4,000. Another example is a four-person family with a gross income of $59,000 would pay almost $400 a month for the same plan. That amounts to over $4,700 a year before any out-of-pocket costs. And those out-of-pocket costs can be over $6,000. Cover Oregon's working with insurers to get good value on benefit of consumers is good even for those getting federal tax subsidies for two reasons. Getting a good deal on covered services and cost sharing helps Oregonians and helps ensure they maintain coverage. Negotiating would involve not only premium prices, but also the quality of care, provider networks, covered services, and cost sharing. Success in those areas in particular would likely produce coverage, allow them to stay with their doctor, and if more of the services they need are covered by an exchange plan and their costs in using those services are within their means to pay, they're more likely to keep the coverage. Secondly, the Affordable Care Act ties any rise in premiums nationally after 2014 to the share of people's income that they will pay towards their premium. To give an example, in 2014, federal subsidies are provided so that a family at 200% of the federal poverty level will pay no more than 6.3% of their income. However, that percentage after 2014 will be adjusted upward to reflect premium growth that exceeds income growth nationally.
Ms. Bauer, I'm going to have to ask you.
Sure. Inflation in healthcare costs is a problem in our nation, across our country, and success in cost control will require state initiatives. We need more state models for solutions. Oregon could be one of the states that demonstrates how progress in this area can be achieved. I thank you very much for your support of the Dash One amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call David Berberg to talk about, react a little bit to this. Members of the committee, it's my impression that, thank you guys, it's my impression that it's maybe a little too early to deal with this bill, but I thought it would be important to hear it and to get some feelings of it and be ready to introduce it in the interim for the February session, when we've had a chance to see how the exchange did, what members they got. Unless there's some sense that we ought to do something different from the committee, that's where I'm planning. So I asked Covered Oregon not to get hysterical about it just yet, but to talk to us about it. And let me get Rose Englert and Elise Brown also with, again, don't get too hysterical about this yet. We're trying this on for size. David, getting your hair on fire is not going to be a problem, I see.
Harsh.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is David Berenberg, and I'm representing Cover Oregon. And first, I'd like to begin with an apology, and I apologize for not being Amy Fauver, who was going to offer some really lively and interesting testimony, but she is ill today, so you're stuck with boring me. Cover Oregon shares the goals of the previous speakers, trying to work towards, you know, quality, affordability, and value for citizens of Oregon, and to really make available health care to so many thousands and thousands of citizens who have not had viable health care options or affordable health care options before. On the issue of quality, we do have adopted a series of quality measures that some resemble those of the CCOs, others are different. We have some differences because our purposes are a little different. Cover Oregon is really focused on helping an individual or a family identify which are the best plans, rather than necessarily having measures that are aimed at transformation of the system. We're trying to be able to cover both in our measures. We believe that our measures, as many of the things we're doing at the start, are things that will need to be reviewed, tweaked, changed, and we're going to establish a technical advisory committee and invite stakeholders and technical experts to participate as we review the quality standards that we have, and also review the evaluation that we will be doing consistently as we move along of just our implementation to see how we can do things better, see what we have learned. We believe that right now, I think as the Chair Greenlick has said, is there are zero individuals receiving health care through the Cover Oregon portal, and zero insurers now that have signed on the dotted line for contracts to provide care through Cover Oregon. The situation will change quickly. We hope beginning open enrollment in October, and when plans are offered in January. We believe we need some flexibility just to see how the system functions once we're open and enrolling people. We are happy to work with the stakeholders, are happy to come back and report to the committee as we move along on implementation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have on any of these issues. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And it's exciting to be here with you all this afternoon after thinking about all the work we did on Senate Bill 99. Some of you weren't here a session or so ago when we had all the discussion about that, and it's hard to believe that we're soon going to be embarking on this great, new, wonderful thing for Oregon. I am here on behalf of my Oregon members today to offer some just general comments in opposition. David stated a lot of my comments up front, but I will add that House Bill 2118 is going to impose a whole sort of additional criteria on the carriers who want to offer plans in the exchange. The requirements are twofold. For those that will participate in the exchange, we have to meet some basic state requirements. Those are one of licensure, compliance with state solvency and market conduct, requirements, filing and review processes, and audit processes. And all of that's done with our state regulator, the Oregon Insurance Division. There's also 9 additional criteria that each carrier has to meet through the Affordable Care Act just to participate in the exchange. So as David said, the count of carriers right now is 0, but that's going to change here really soon. In fact, by the end of April, carriers will have filed their rates to participate in the exchange. So there's a lot of interest right now. We want to make sure that we can continue the interest in the exchange. So before we go changing things that have yet to be tested, let's give this a year at least to see how we do. You know, we'll have questions that we'll want to ask at the end of this time. How many carriers are actually going to sign on and enter into contracts? How many commercial products are going to be available in all parts of the state? And who renews in 2015? So these are all questions that need time to answer, and I ask that you give us the time to do that so we can continue to make this a very successful thing for Oregon and Oregon consumers. You also have testimony in front of you by another AHIP member, Pacific Source, who did a very good job of outlining a lot of the requirements that every carrier has to undergo to participate. So that's it, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Rose Englert. I'm here on behalf of Care Oregon, which is a 501c3 organization providing health plan services for Oregon's health co-op, which will be offering products on the exchange. To echo the thoughts of a lot of folks before, we absolutely believe in what this bill is trying to do. We believe in keeping costs low. We believe in providing accountability and ensuring that we have quality plans that have good outcomes, satisfaction scores, and choice for members. That being said, we do oppose the Dash 1 amendments to 2118 in that we feel that the tools necessary to meet the goals that the Dash 1 amendments are trying to get to are already in place through a number of very credible expert organizations. NCQA or URAC are accrediting organizations that all commercial insurers offering on the exchange will have to have accreditation from within the first year of the exchange. Again, through the Pacific Source testimony that you have written in front of you, you can see just part of what that accreditation looks like. Speaking from experience, Care Oregon went through an NCQA certification just a couple years ago and know firsthand how much it really does touch all of these measures that the Dash 1 amendments are trying to get at. We do believe that the way that the bill is written under the Dash 1 puts redundant and unnecessary qualifications onto plans that we are already going to be meeting and possibly exceeding. When Dash 1 is discussed as a cost-saving measure, I would disagree saying that it actually could drive up the cost of care because of the redundancies and because of the enhanced amount of work that plans have to do, as well as the enhanced amount of work that the exchange would have to do, that CoverOregon would have to do, and we'd be concerned about those costs. We want to continue to work on affordability. We want to continue to make sure that we have quality plans, and we'll continue to work with advocates on how those things can be addressed. But we do not believe that 2118-1 is the way to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to end this public hearing. I have to apologize to Lee Mercer for not giving an opportunity, but please submit written testimony. My sense is, as I said before, unless I hear otherwise, we'll hold this over till the interim and give the exchange a chance at least to get their breath up. But I really, David, I really recommend you let Rocky know that we have some real interest in going in this direction, so it'll be a good advanced discussion. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2118 and open up an informational session on child hunger in Oregon to the Oregon Food Bank and move from there to a public hearing on House Bill 2921. And you have 20 minutes.
Oh, okay. We might be quicker than that.
Good.
If that is helpful.
Then we'll have more time to talk about the bill, which is quite relevant to this topic.
We are waiting for a PowerPoint, but I'll go ahead and get started. So Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thanks for inviting us here today to talk about our work. My name is Beth Cohen. I work for Oregon Food Bank. I'm here with Liz Adams, who works at OHSU, and we're both members of the Childhood Hunger Coalition. We're here today to talk broadly about childhood hunger in Oregon and also about the Childhood Hunger Coalition, which is one of Oregon Food Bank's programs that works to address childhood hunger and is at the intersection of healthcare and hunger. And that's why we're excited to be here to talk to you about our work today. So the main focus of the Childhood Hunger Coalition's work is around engaging with the healthcare community around hunger as a public health concern, and specifically getting healthcare providers that are on the ground working with children and families to integrate an awareness about hunger as a health concern and its health impacts, and to understand what food resources are available, such as SNAP, which is, you know, the former food stamps, and WIC, to be able to get healthcare providers to integrate that information and empower them to help connect families with those resources. And this work is driven by the belief that folks that are on the ground working with children and families have an obligation to help them access food and connect them to food assistance resources. And in that vein, we're excited to be here today to tell you a little bit about our work and the resources that we've developed, and to begin a conversation with you about how this work could be a resource for healthcare transformation discussions moving forward, and a resource for healthcare system stakeholders and other healthcare settings. So as many of you know, children in Oregon are disproportionately burdened by poverty and hunger. A quarter of all children in Oregon are living at or below the federal poverty level, and about a third of all children in Oregon are experiencing food insecurity, which makes Oregon one of the highest rates of food insecurity in the country. And we see this at Oregon Food Bank in our service statistics, where about a third of all individuals accessing emergency food from an Oregon Food Bank network emergency food box are children. And that's so each month across the state, 92,000 children are eating emergency food from the Oregon Food Bank statewide network. And we also see that about half of all children in Oregon qualify for free and reduced price meals. So we know it's a really big problem. And I'm sure also many of you also know that there's a really strong link between food insecurity and health and growth and developmental outcomes of children. And without intervention, even minimal exposure to food insecurity can develop lasting impacts on children that really stay with them throughout their life. There's been a lot of research that's looked at the link between food insecurity and health outcomes, developmental outcomes, emotional well-being, academic achievement. So we know that children that experience food insecurity are more likely to suffer from headaches and stomach aches and respiratory infections and be at risk for nutritional deficiency like anemia. We know that children suffering from food insecurity have a harder time focusing in school, paying attention, which is kind of a no-brainer. It's hard to pay attention when you're hungry. And also due to more time being sick or missing more days of school, and are more likely to repeat a grade and sort of fall behind in school. And we also know that there's a link between food insecurity and social and emotional well-being for children and teens, actually. For children, it manifests in behavior problems, frustration, lack of attentiveness, and then for teens, it manifests in mental health issues and depression. And then we also know that, you know, there is this connection between being at risk for obesity and dealing with food insecurity. We don't know exactly how that link is made, but we do know that kids that are growing up dealing with food insecurity can develop eating habits where you have an inconsistent access to food, and it instills eating habits that really aren't healthy for you as an adult later on in life. But we also know that food assistance resource programs, like those I mentioned before, SNAP SNAP and WIC and emergency food and other food assistance for families and households actually play a pretty significant role in helping families and children mitigate some of the worst impacts of food insecurity, as mentioned above. So that connection is really important to make. And so it's these factors that drove the Childhood Hunger Coalition to form in 2004. It's an interdisciplinary group of healthcare providers and anti-hunger advocates that formed around the need to educate and engage with the healthcare community around the link between food insecurity and poor health outcomes for children. And over the last several years, the coalition has been guided by a steering committee of individuals represented on the list here. So Food Bank, Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, Kaiser Permanente, OHSU, OSU Extension, Oregon Health Authority, and Oregon WIC. And Oregon Food Bank has been a member of the coalition since its inception, but as of 2011, the coalition formally became a program of Oregon Food Bank. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Liz, and she's going to talk about some more of our program work.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you, committee. It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me?
Oh, here.
It was just coincidentally the week that I moved to Oregon.
Can you introduce yourself?
What? Oh, sorry. I'm Liz Adams. I'm from Oregon Health Sciences University, and I'm here as part of the Child Hunger Coalition. When I moved to Oregon, that happened to be the week that we had a meeting that launched the Child Hunger Coalition, unbeknownst to me. But that just was my start in Oregon, and I've been thrilled to be taking part in activities of the Childhood Hunger Coalition since then. As Beth mentioned, the Childhood Hunger Coalition formed around the idea that healthcare providers can play a pivotal role in identifying food insecurity in children and helping to address that need. One of the first projects that we undertook as a coalition was to carry out a survey of healthcare providers throughout the state of Oregon to ask them what they knew about food insecurity and if they would be willing to screen for food insecurity in their clinic. And providers knew a lot about food insecurity, and they were overwhelmingly willing to screen for food insecurity if they had information about how to do that, how to ask families about their food situation, and they also wanted to be sure that they could have access to resources to connect families too. So that then identified, based on that information, we went forward and developed some educational materials and some tools for providers. We developed educational materials. We developed a screen and intervene algorithm, which you will have, or you do have, a copy of.
In the toolkit.
We also developed an online continuing medical education course about food insecurity and its health and education impacts, which you can access through this website mentioned here, or looking at childhoodhunger.org. Do you have the educational toolkits?
Or you should all have one of those at your...
Oh, it's okay. So in these toolkits, which we've now also distributed to over 2,000 providers in Oregon, that has information about, it has the algorithm, and it has information about resources that providers can use, can refer for families to. Another tool that we developed is we developed educational digest that's available online and can be accessed through this site too, and that gives a lot of the current literature that's important in guiding our action. Childhood Hunger Coalition has now undertaken a pilot project to look at how well this screen and intervene algorithm works. We're partnering with OHSU to evaluate the impact of screening families for food insecurity and intervening to address the problem of food insecurity. We are building on work that OHSU Well Child Clinics have recently implemented as standard care to ask families about food insecurity, and we are partnering with them to look and see how well that tool is working in a clinic setting. How much time does it take for a doctor to ask those questions, and are they successful in trying to link families with resources? And when they do that, does it make a difference to the families? We're hoping...
Define food insecurity.
What?
Can you define
food? Food insecurity is the condition when a family doesn't know that they have enough food to get... They don't know if they have access to enough food. They don't know if they have access to nutritious and affordable food. Okay. And it can happen. Families can... It can be a transient situation, or it can be something that's ongoing for a long time.
If they don't know they have enough, or if they don't have enough?
It could be, it can be either the concern, families first may feel a concern about not having enough food, and then they may have sort of a later stage is to actually not have enough food to actually cut back on the food that you're eating and not be getting a nutritionally adequate diet. So it's sort of, first it's the psychological aspect, the concern, and then it's the physical changes in the diet.
Thank you.
And I think there's two, sorry if I can just jump in. I think there's a quality dimension and a quantity. So there's the access, you know, do you have enough food, and then what is the quality, nutritional quality of the food. So there's two dimensions as well.
That's it.
Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's good. Interruptions are welcome.
Here's another one.
Representative Clem?
Yeah. Okay. Since their interruptions are welcome. So on the access question, are you also, I just can't remember who it is that might be working on surveying food deserts?
We're not doing that right now. I think there, I know of a number of different groups in Oregon and Washington that are doing that. Do you have a specific name?
You know, I think... I'm not sure. I mean, that's like a USDA term, and they sort of measure and define U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they look at that. I'm not sure what, I mean, I can dig in and find some more info about that, but I don't know which reference you're,
So the thing I'm thinking about, it may be that it's not included in the definition of food insecure, but on the access side, it's definitely... what we think about. So you know, there was a big article in the Oregonian a few years ago about one woman who lived in a neighborhood where it took 8 hours by bus to get to a grocery store that wasn't just selling, you know, cooked 7-Eleven type foods on the corner and whatever else they had. So some states address it by incenting local markets by buying produce cases for them. So the infrastructure that's already there can help provide better quality foods. Others, like I think it's Pennsylvania, I forget the name of the initiative, they use tax credits to get grocery stores to locate in areas they otherwise wouldn't. But I don't know if that's really not what the... you know, whatever hunger community calls food insecurity, and that's more something else, not having access to anything reasonably healthy anywhere in your neighborhood.
No, I think it's all tied together. And I don't think you can separate it. In fact, here in Oregon, there's a lot of different groups that are acting on those gaps in food supply. And I think of Oregon State University and Sharon Thornberry at Oregon Food Bank, and the Hunger Task Force has called together meetings in different locations around the state to call on community members to identify what they can do to improve the food situation and address those food deserts in their communities.
Yeah, I think the Hunger Committee looks at it, you know, we have sort of the emergency food, that sort of baseline, the first step for people that are really in emergency situations, but then there's a whole set of programs and projects that are dedicated to, you know, improving the food environment, allowing people to have increased access, especially to healthy food, and so I think that's a huge part of it.
Thank you.
Hey, guys.
Okay. Let's see. So from our pilot, we will develop best practices. And then we'll go to the next slide. Currently, I'm not going to be able to report results of our project to you today because it's in progress. We're collecting data still. But we've just closed data collection for this six-month project, and there's over 85 families currently enrolled in the study. Families that are enrolled in the study, once their provider identifies that they screen positive for food insecurity, then we'll ask them to complete a more complete food security assessment that focuses on their children, and then we'll ask them to complete a survey again 6 months later. So far, as I said, we have over 85 families enrolled. Although we don't have results, we do have some information from providers as we've gone along that can help to inform how this is going. Providers have been very willing to be involved in this project. I think they've been surprised that the families that have been identified as food insecure, they're not necessarily the people they would have thought would be food insecure. They may be some other people. And let's see. Families also have been very, I think families have been happy to be able to have this question raised because then they can get that need addressed. So I've had families search me out and call me in my office at OHSU and say, you know, we want to be in the study, and how can we do that? So I think it's been a positive for families, too. So overall, this, I think, is an important next step that we're taking with the Childhood Hunger Coalition, and we're looking forward to having an evidence-based model for food security assessment, intervention, and the clinical screening. We know that the lessons learned and best practices is something that we'll be able to share with other clinics in a wide range of settings. I know that different clinics have expressed their interest to me in doing that. And we're seeing this as a real opportunity that we can harness the power of the healthcare community to identify this problem and address it in the families that we see all across Oregon. So thank you very much.
Well, I've dealt with physicians in these kind of intervention studies. The main question is, if I identify somebody, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I heard you saying pretty specifically of what tools those physicians will have to say, okay, you're food insecure, now here's how you deal with it.
Okay. No, that's a good question, and that's exactly the concern that physicians raised when they answered our survey. So provide the screening tool to them, but we also provide them within the toolkit. There's a range of resources.
So CV, yeah.
Yeah, so we'll be linking. They know to link to the existing programs like WIC and food stamps and so forth, and those are listed in there. Cooperative Extension has created a tool that's online that gives county by county what the food resources are in that community, and it's available currently in English and Spanish. So that is something providers can use, and in fact, we've integrated that into Epic so that a provider can say, this family is from...
That's the electronic medical...
Sorry, yes. So it's in the electronic medical record. The provider can say, this is a family from Crook County, and I've identified food insecurity, so here are the food resources that you can go and look at, and call me if there's problems getting to any of these resources. I don't know what they say exactly, but so that's the idea. So we're trying to use existing resources. So,
okay.
Other questions?
Well, thank you both very much. Well, we have a bill up. We'll see if we can do something about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2921. Can you tell us what that's about? Well, our vice chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2921 appropriates $500,000 from the general fund to Oregon Health Authority for the 2013-2015 biennium to the Women, Infants, and Children program for the purpose of providing fresh Oregon-grown fruits, vegetables, and cut herbs to eligible individuals.
I'm sure we'll hear about it, but this bill has a very large number of bipartisan and bicameral supporters. So, and we have the ability to, it is going to Ways and Means, we have the ability to move it there today if we so desire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer. I represent House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. I'm really honored to introduce this bill today. It does have a huge amount of bipartisan support. It actually has 40 out of 60 people in the House have signed it. That's two-thirds. All of you except for one, and that's just my inability to get around to everyone on the floor, I guess, and 17 out of 30 in the Senate. Again, I don't spend as much time over there, but everyone has been very willing. They see that this is an incredible win-win. This is one of the tools when you've identified food insecurity. I was late to this hearing today because I was introducing two similar bills in the Education Committee, which are to expand our after-school meal and snack program as well as our summer breakfast program. We know how important nutrition is for our 40-40-20 goals, for our CCO goals, create a healthy community, and we know that it impacts children particularly, And we also know that we have to keep going upstream and going to pregnant women and young children. So the WIC program serves 178,000 women and young children in our community. Last year, there was an expansion of this because there was some extra money in the federal government. And only one, the mother, the pregnant or young mother, and up to, I think it's two children, are eligible. They can't, if she has lots of children, only up to two children in a family. So up to three people are eligible to get these vouchers. So out of the 178,000, 100,000 were eligible, and 90,000 of them made use of this program when there was some extra money that was put into the system. We as a state usually put in around 220,000, something like this. This would be an expansion of what we put into the program. The reason I got a lot of signatures on it is I wanted this bill to come in with very strong support, because 500,000, you know, is a lot to ask in Ways and Means, and yet it goes a long way, not only for these families, but also for the farmers markets throughout our state. So there are other people that I think are going to testify briefly. They can fill in details. This additional investment would allow 12,500 more mothers and children to benefit from the program. So I'm really honored and excited about it. I also think that Representative Clem's proposal on was a similar idea for the farm to school program. Again, these are different ways that we as a state can partner with farmers in our communities to improve nutrition for our youth. So thank you. Any questions?
While we're thinking about questions, let me bring up Robin Johnson, Philip Kennedy Wong. Sarah Larson, would you like to join us as well? You've been recruited.
Maybe we could pull up an extra chair there for her.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think we only have three, right?
Well, I think if she comes up with her daughter.
Okay.
I can sit down.
You can bring your daughter up here to sit with you.
Okay, the kids.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh.
Here we go.
Oh my gosh, she's going to come up here?
She's going to come and sit with Daddy.
Oh, jeez.
Is that your dad?
Oh. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Robin Johnson, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2921. This would give $500,000 to farm direct nutrition programs for WIC families, for WIC participants. So as you know, the program gives vouchers for $20 to the families to spend at farmers markets and farm stands. And just to reiterate, this also gives, so they're able to buy fresh fruits and vegetables and herbs from Oregon farmers. And this gives Oregon farmers a revenue stream that they may not have otherwise had. So the WIC program did a little bit of interviewing at the 2013 Small Farms Conference, and they got some input and some quotes from farmers about what this program does for them. And one exuberant farmer shared this quote in the succinct manner that only farmers can. He said, "The only thing I want to say about Farm Direct is that it's great. We need to continue it and keep expanding," period. There's the quote. So clearly supported by Oregon farmers who really see a need that they're filling in the communities. So many of you know that WIC is the premier public health program in our country. And one thing that Farm Direct does is that it takes the nutrition education that WIC families are getting as a part of the benefit that they receive, and it's extending it into areas that they may not naturally be inclined to participate in. For some families, going to the farmers market is second nature. They've been doing it all their life. But this is really an invitation that we're giving low-income folks
with young children to begin to develop food habits that will serve them through their lifetime. And you know that there is also a program, a partner program that serves seniors. We're not going to talk about this today, but we're really seeing, we're preparing our kids to be able to use one of the great benefits of living in Oregon, which is our tremendous bounty across the state that happens in the form of farmers markets. And we know that it's something that can serve kids from the moment they're born throughout their whole lives. And so I'm available to answer any questions, and I would ask you to please support the bill. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for record, Philip Kennedy Wong. I'll keep my comments very, very brief. And I, before I do, I want to thank you and this committee for allowing us to present to you just a few moments ago on childhood hunger in Oregon. Clearly, it's a priority for Oregon Food Bank. We do emphatically support this bill because, like farmers, we're in the business of feeding people. And I think if you ask any farmer, why they do what they do is to actually, feed people, obviously. And for Oregon Food Bank, having distributed for the last two consecutive years 81 million pounds of food statewide, roughly over a million emergency food boxes, and about 10% of that 80 million pounds are locally grown crops that we distribute, we know that we alone can't do it. So we need to expand the number of venues in which families and individuals experiencing hunger can access Oregon-grown crops. So this program is a very important part of the toolbox for fighting hunger, especially for getting healthy and nutritious Oregon-grown crops to families that need it. So that sort of is my simplistic testimony. I appreciate anything you can do to pass this bill to the next step.
Mr. Larson, I hear you have something to talk to us about with hungry kids, huh?
I was told I do.
Yeah. I had some experience with this.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name
besides this big hungry kid.
I know. My name is Sarah Larson, and I'm the founder of an organization called Backpack Snacks. And what we do is we provide food over the weekends to children who don't get any food when their diets aren't supported by school lunch during the week. And so our idea is that food insecure children can be identified by teachers in schools, and that way all kids need to go to school, and right at that point then we can identify these kids and get them the food that they need. And a lot of times I feel like there's a stigma with asking for food or seeking out some help, and this way kids are given the food that they need and it's put into their backpacks over the weekend and they're provided with the food that they need. And I'm not sure what else.
How many do you do?
Right now we're starting over at McKinley. We're going to start April 5th and we're covering the whole school. There are 23 kids who need the program. And then after we support McKinley, we're going to support them all year, and we plan to move to Candelaria and add a school every subsequent year. But what's nice about our program is over the weekend it only costs $2.50 to $3.50 to provide the kids with all the food that they need. And so to support a whole school, it only costs $2,500 for a whole year to make sure that these kids have the food that they need.
This is great. My daughter's a third grade teacher and worries about her kids with it, which they feed morning and noon and after school, and then she... Yeah. Very worried about what happens over the weekend.
These programs are set up all over the country, and a lot of testimonies from teachers just say that they're able to teach more effectively because they don't have to worry about their kids and where they're going to get their next meal.
Okay. Are there any questions, this panel, before we move into a work session? Thank you very much. You want to hit this thing with the hammer? Good. Close the informational hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2921. We have the ability to move this to Ways and Means. We have what we need. Is there any Any objection?
Oh, that's great.
Any? Well, let's have a motion.
Mr. Chair. The picture is darling. Oh, that wrong motion. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. A little out of order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2921 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The bill be transferred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2921 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
I just wanted to mention a couple of things by way of advocacy, not that it's necessary, but under the circumstances, I think my view of this bill is certainly colored by personal experience and my fondness for the WIC program. I can't remember if Amy and I benefited from WIC with two of our children or three, but our first two boys, we were eligible for WIC, and it was very, very helpful. And unlike a lot of safety net programs, this is oriented towards good nutrition, food where it needs to be, which is for young mothers and children, and is, I think, very effective at delivering both the food, but also information, and really hits right exactly where it's needed most. The other, so obviously, no mystery. I'm going to vote for this bill. Hopefully, when it comes to the floor of the House too. The other part I wanted to mention, and this is not the farm to food program, but I thought I should give a shameless plug for the Bendel Pine Schools, which have been very successful in developing a farm to school program that is cost effective. They work in close cooperation with Oregon farmers throughout Oregon, but also local and central Oregon, but really throughout the state. And if you ever get a chance and you're over in Bend, let me know, and you can go in and participate in the school lunch program. It is nothing like what we had when we were going to school in the school lunch program. And the amazing thing about it is that they, although it takes a lot of work, a lot of effort, they've been successful in keeping it very, very cost effective too. And the cost per meal, I've now forgotten what it is, but it's less than $1 per meal, I believe, which is phenomenal and nutritious and local and supports the economy and everything else that you would hope for. So this is an opportunity, I guess, to vote for both in some respects, and I'm happy to do it.
I understand the kids still won't eat beets. They think beets look like rotten potatoes.
Well, that's without even talking about the taste, but there's other stuff they will eat that's very nutritious and locally grown.
Yes, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing that is interesting about these kinds of farm-to-institution programs that isn't well known is how, this one obviously is a lifeline for the eater, but sometimes these farmers market and farm stands are the lifeline for the growers too. And I can tell you that there's this category of grower who's not the small one who only goes to farmers markets, and they're not the big ones that only exports. They're sort of in the middle, and they do both usually. And at least in our situation on our orchard, there was a time around 2000, the year 2000, when many growers were ripping out whole blocks of certain types of fruit. It was on the front page of the Oregonian, pears in particular. It was a terrible price crash. And we also had a bunch of apples as well that were, we were getting like $15 for a big 800-pound bin of them, so almost 2 cents a pound. Well, it cost 12 cents a pound just to have it picked, let alone growing it. And so we started a fruit stand because it was better than dumping them in the fields, which is what my father-in-law told me to do, because it was going to be such a huge money loser. And so we had a fruit stand for several years just out on the street corner here in Salem. I'd drive them all the way down from Hood River in the the night before on a Friday, and then sell them all weekend and go back and get more Saturday and come back. But, you know, we made more money in our fruit stand. The orchard lost money under the whole big global agriculture system. We lost money. On the fruit stand, we made money. And it was it wasn't enough to keep the business going forever. The other one needed to turn around or else we would have not been in the orcharding business. But it was the people who are doing both, these are particularly useful to have a guaranteed base of customers, whether it's a school or a prison or the farmer, you know, WIC program, having those lifelines available for security, because, you know, a lot of these people relied on the giant, big, global food agriculture system, and that doesn't always work out so well either, it turns out. And a lot of farmers have struggled under that system. So having some options where you know your own tax dollars are going to go to support buying your products is quite useful.
I'd like to comment. Some of you know I've been involved in evaluating intervention programs over the last 40 years, and I was peripherally involved in the first national evaluation of WIC. There has never been a public health program that proved so clearly to meet its objectives and to be useful in terms of, I mean, it was hands down, no question about how important WIC was. So this would help our participation. I support it. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Quinn?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Harper?
Yes.
Representative Penner?
Aye.
Representative Weider?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair
Greenman? Aye. Motion carries. The bill goes to Ways and Means, and if you have an opportunity to talk to anybody in the Ways and Means Committee, let them know how important we think this bill is. And unless there's anything else to come before us?
Mr. Chair, they should consider actually putting food stamps in the same, running it the way they run WIC, in all honesty. So then we wouldn't have the obesity problem that we had in the Medicaid system.
Putting more in the food stamps program. I think you can use food stamps now at
well, just the whole, right? Yeah, but to where they're not buying sodas, pizzas, and because they're not going, yeah.
Their nutrition list needs revamped. Nutritious yes. list.
Our supplemental nutrition.
Well, when you get program. Elected to Congress, you can take that on. We're adjourned.
Yeah. Together another meaningless resolution.